Thomas Walk, here representing the appellant Janine Browning in this matter. We're here this morning because a series of rulings by the trial court that were incomplete, inaccurate, and prejudicial to Ms. Browning. The majority of these erroneous rulings are apparent on the face of the letter opinion issued by the trial court in July of 2016.
Mr. Walk, there's an issue regarding one transcript in particular that apparently was not filed with the clerk of the trial court until January the 19th.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Which is 2 days after it was due to be filed with the clerk of the trial court. And I'm going to ask some questions about that. But the first one is, regarding the assignments of error, it seems to me that that transcript is critical to resolving them, that we really can't resolve them if that transcript's not before us. Do you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Okay. Well, then my next question is, tell me why you think it's properly before us, given that it was filed out of time.
Judge, it was filed with the trial court rather than the clerk. This case is one that is a Washington County case because that is where the defendant was residing.
And Judge Showalter does not reside there.
He does not reside there. That's correct. And all the hearings that we have had in front of him have been held in Wythe County. And that is where the court reporter delivered the transcript to him well in advance of, actually, before his issuing his final ruling.
And then apparently, sometime afterwards, he had several things, including some letters that counsel had sent to him in Wythe County, kind of almost letter briefs, because there are several documents that all bear the clerk's stamp of January 19, 2017, that are bang, 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 one of which is the transcript. And so at some point, he came to Washington County and turned over his case file.
That's my understanding.
Given that the rule is very specific and Rule 5A1 in its definitions defines what a clerk of the trial court is and what a trial judge is, and they are different things, how do we help you?
Judge, our position would be that the appellee, Mr. Browning, is not prejudiced at all by the transcript not being filed with the clerk, despite what the rule says.
Well, and on prejudice, that's clearly an element of failure to file a notice of filing transcript, and I agree with you, given the emails you attached to your response to the motion, it's pretty clear that there are no prejudices attached, but the actual filing of the transcript, the rule doesn't have a prejudice component. It is either in front of us or it is not.
Judge, our position would be that the spirit of the rules were complied with the transcript being filed with the actual fact finder. If you'll read through his decision letter of July of 2016, he actually erroneously refers to Ms. Browning's testimony as being by way of deposition. So that's a clear indication that the transcript was there with him.
Unless my colleagues have more on that, I think you've answered my questions on that, and we want to get your merits.
Thank you. The most significant or consequential error by the trial court was his failure to credit Ms. Browning with her separate interest in the property located at St. Simons Island, Georgia. The trial court did make a specific finding that the down payment of a little bit over $206,000 came from Ms. Browning's separate property. It was part of a tax-free Section 1031 exchange.
Tax fraud was committed, we know exactly where that money came from.
That is correct. And the trial court stopped at that point in looking at it as separate property and jumped immediately to it being transmuted into marital property. And we can see that when the property was titled in both names, that did constitute a transmutation. But then the trial court failed to take the next step to see if we had properly traced that separate interest.
Let me take you back to the money that was acquired as a result of this exchange. That was done during the marriage, was it not?
That is correct.
Why isn't that marital property?
Judge, I believe that that is something that, as I stated in my brief, would be an arguable point for the appellee to make, but Judge Showalter found that it was separate property, and I think we are stuck with that finding at this point, since they have not assigned that as cross error.
Where did he make that finding that the proceeds of that
that is in his letter of opinion, and if you will read,
you're talking about page 914 of the appendix.
That sounds
where he says the court finds that the wife acquired the separate property during the marriage, which was used as purchase of the Georgia property. Is that the sentence you're...
Well, the entire section.
Okay.
I think it has to be read as a whole.
Well, he clearly indicates that... he uses the term, he says separate, but he has separate in quotes. And I read that to mean a reference to property the wife alleges to be separate property, not a finding of separate property.
Okay. I understand that reading, and that's why I think that section has to be read as a whole, because on page 915, he goes on to say, all of the wife's separate interest in other accounts used in the tax-free exchange were transmuted to marital property. And we would submit that that constitutes a finding that the down payment was separate property that he deemed to be transmuted.
It couldn't transmute if it wasn't separate.
It wasn't. That's correct. In the appellee's brief, he quibbles with my citation of the Holden decision, which I said was indistinguishable from the current situation. It is factually indistinguishable, but what the appellee would create would be a situation where separate property acquired before marriage is in a different category than separate property acquired after marriage. And I'm not aware of any holdings by this court or the Virginia Supreme Court that goes to that extent. Holden may be factually distinguishable, but legally I don't believe that it is, because it was very clearly a tracing case, just the same as this one is. The next item that we will argue is with regard to the court's distribution, manner of distribution of the tangible personal property located in Georgia. As you may be familiar, the court said, I want each of you to put the items in a hat and pick by lot. That's not a means of distribution that's ever been authorized by this court. The appellee cites that.
Whether authorized or not, is it illegal or unacceptable to do that?
It's not unacceptable, because the court did not go through the process of classifying, valuing, and then dividing.
Well, the court stated before it did that it could not determine factually as to any of the personal effects located in Georgia. So the trial court was basically saying, I can't make a determination as to whose separate property is what. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an alternative where you can go ahead and come up with an equitable resolution of the issues that are before the court. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that that would be an abdication of his responsibilities to decide what is equitable. If parties could decide between themselves.
He decided what was equitable, which was, you know, the NFL draft brought to the divorce law.
Well, this is true, but the NFL draft is not governed by the equitable distribution statute.
Was the argument made to the trial court that this was not a proper way to divide the property, or was it just an objection noted on the final order?
I believe that I included that in my post-trial. It may just be in the objections.
Well, the Hebel-Heinrich case talks about the fact that in that case they used a hat method, too.
Right.
And it was decided in Hebel-Heinrich that the trial court's method was unorthodox, but it has each party keeping the items currently in his or her possession to be an acceptable way to divide up personal items if the value cannot be determined. It seems that the court made the predicate finding that the value could not be determined and came up with a methodology to divide the property. And I believe if the court had not done something, he would be here arguing, as you are now, that the court had a responsibility to do something about this property.
Your Honor, I believe the disposition in Hobel Heinrich was the court actually leaving the parties with ownership and possession of whatever they had in hand at that time. That is the.
But that would suffer from the same flaw that you raised here, that he didn't actually value it and divvy it up dollar for dollar.
Correct. And we would actually be in favor of a result similar to Hobel Heinrich at this point.
Well, did he say that it was not subject to being valued? Or there was no proof of value?
He said there was no proof of value.
Well, if there's no proof of value, then it's not subject to equitable distribution. It's whoever possesses it owns it.
I think that's a correct statement, Your Honor.
And your client happens to possess it, or at least possessed it all.
The items were in her hands. What those items were is something that a little bit unclear as well. With regard to the retroactive.
You're into your rebuttal.
I'm sorry.
You can continue if you wish. You can reserve the remainder.
I'll reserve the remainder.
Thank you. And Mr. Gallenbach, for you, I didn't mention this earlier, Mr. Walker, our timing lights are up here on the bench because the cord won't reach the podium. So.
Morning, judges. My name is Robert Gallenbach. I represent the appellee in this case, and I want to start with the technical errors, which I've cited. I filed a motion pre-brief for dismissal, and I also took it up in my brief with regard to dismissal.
Mr. Gallenbach, on the transcripts that you raised, the notice of filing transcripts, you have to demonstrate some prejudice. Given that apparently you had it, the trial judge had it, everybody had all these transcripts the whole time, what prejudice do you assert from the failure of the notice to file transcripts?
Appellant is correct on that issue.
Okay.
With regard, however, to not filing the transcript, you know, one of the things that could have cured it, and it's up to the appellant to make sure everything's in the record, one of the things that could have cured that is to have the judge mark it as filed when he received it. At least there'd be something in the record that way. For instance, when you accept a piece of evidence, the judge marks the exhibit and then he puts his initials on it to mark it filed. Here, there's no indication of when it comes into the record, and I come up with the fact that it was 4 days late because December only had 30 days in it.
Yeah, but you're forgetting Martin Luther King Day.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a big one.
I'm sorry. I missed that on the calendar. So it was, in fact, 2 days late. And I don't think that that rule, I don't believe I have to show any prejudice, and I don't believe the court can ignore that rule. In fact, that rule was changed at one point, because at one point it said the trial judge was the one who could give the extension when it was first adopted, and then later it was changed so that this court could grant an extension.
Mr. Gallenbach, if this transcript, if Judge Showalter had been a sitting judge in this, what was it, Washington County?
Yes.
If it had been a sitting judge in Washington County and the court reporter brought the transcript in and laid it on the judge's desk and it remained on the judge's desk and he just simply neglected to carry it down to the clerk's office, would you be making the same argument?
Yes, sir. It's up to the appellant to make sure that it is filed within the time limits. There are no exceptions. The only exception would have been if Mr. Walk realized that it was not filed within the 60-day period, he could have petitioned this court for good cause shown to have it filed within a 90-day period. And he did not do that. He never petitioned the court to have an extension even after I filed my motion. So
Your position, counsel, is that the failure to file the transcript is fatal.
Yes.
To the appeal. And if it is indeed fatal, which suggests to me the end of all, why is there a prejudice component even discussed in the context of our cases?
The prejudice is as to the notice of the filing. He didn't file his notice of the filing. Even after objection, he didn't file the notice of the filing of the transcripts either. And I do have to show prejudice in that regard.
So you've conceded that that portion of your motion is not well-founded, as I understood your answer to my
question. I agree with the appellant on that point. Yes, sir.
Mr. Galanek, let me ask you about the merits. I think I understand your argument as to the transcript.
Okay, could I add one, just
oh,
one
I'm
thing
sorry,
first? The one thing I want to add is that the court cannot look outside the record. Mr. Walk has asked the court to look outside the record. And in Atkins versus Commonwealth, which is a speedy trial case, the court made it clear that the court can't look to evidence or argument outside the record. To do so would diminish the sanctity of the court's records. Thank you. Sorry.
That's all right. No, I didn't mean to cut you off. But I am interested in the issue involving whether the Georgia property was partially marital, partially separate. It appears that both parties entered into a property settlement agreement on August 8, 1997, where the husband agreed to convey all his right, title, and interest in their residence in Abington and Richmond. And then that became the subject of a portion of the down payment for the purchase of the property. I don't understand why that isn't her separate property, the funds from the sale of those two residents.
Okay, I think what we have to do is look at the distinction in the code between marital and separate property. Marital property does not attach to title. So what we have here is we're talking about value of property. So, I mean, the court works with values of property, not the property itself.
But the
inequitable distribution.
The money used for the down payment,
yes, sir,
in the exchange was separate property, wasn't it?
No, sir, I don't believe it was. It was partially came from the husband in this case. And I don't believe it was acquired by her.
Isn't that agreement a valid property settlement agreement?
No, sir. Nowhere in it does it say that it's exempt from equitable distribution. Nowhere in it does it say that it is separate property.
Well, he conveyed all his right, title, and interest.
Correct.
That would why wouldn't that include his marital interest?
Well, because marital interest isn't actually in the property. It's in the value of the property. So he may have conveyed all his right property, his right, title, and interest, but he did not convey. I mean, every property settlement you see says that people forego their right to equitable distribution because of the property settlement agreement. Nowhere in that property settlement agreement does it say or state that it is separate property.
And that may be good practice, but if I say I convey all my interest, how can I have an interest remaining? All is...
Well, I think...
To use it in its own definition, isn't all encompassing? Doesn't it erase all of my interests of whatever kind?
I think the case of Garland versus Garland, 12 Virginia App 192, is on point. That is a case where the husband conveyed by deed to the wife all his right, title, and interest to the property, to the wife. And the court said that it was still marital property because it came from the husband.
But in Schenck, the language is, quote, all generally means the entirety. And we said that where the facts clearly and unambiguously support the conclusion that one of the parties has relinquished all right and interest in marital property and has transferred those rights unconditionally to the other, it's separate property. Now, the court interpreted the agreement, and I guess it's up to us to interpret the agreement, but it uses the word all, and Schenck says all generally means the entirety.
Yes, and I understand that y'all will have to make a decision, but I'm frankly hoping y'all don't get that far to make that decision. But it's still our position that it is marital. When she conveyed it back into the marriage, it again became marital property. And
and that goes to, what is your response to her argument that Judge Showalter's letter, when it talks about how this became transmuted back into marital property, well, then definitionally, didn't he have to find it wasn't marital property for it to be transmuted back into marital property?
I think the court needs to apply right finding, wrong reason. which the court has done on numerous occasions, where you find that the finding is correct, but the reasoning behind it is wrong.
But if the factual finding is that it's separate property, if that's the finding, and you didn't assign error to the finding that it was separate property, we can't reach it because we haven't been asked to set it aside in any way. I mean, don't you have to challenge if that statement that it became marital property, it transmuted, means that it was separate property that bought the property, the down payment. Don't you have to challenge that ruling?
In my brief, I did. I mean, before before he reached his decision, my memorandum opinion, my memorandum said specifically that it was not separate property.
You didn't ask us to find that that factual determination was an error, did you?
No, sir. But if he reached, I'm asking you to uphold his finding. And if his finding is right, then the court can say correct finding, wrong reason. I don't think that I have to bring that up as error in the case. Another thing I want to discuss is the appellant's failure to tell you where to look in the record for his for the error committed. That's supposed to be done with each assignment of error. And I want to point out, not only is it not in the assignment of error, but there are no citations to the record in the statement of the facts by the appellant in this case. And let's see. This court has previously held that it will not, trying to find my site here.
We will not.
Here we go. It's a Huffman versus Huffman judge. It's an unpublished opinion, but I'm citing it because it takes a quote from a published opinion in Huffman versus Huffman. And it says that in Buchanan versus Buchanan, or Buchanan versus Buchanan, I don't know which, 14 Virginia App 53 at page 56, generally we do not search the record for error in order to interpret appellant's contention and correct deficiencies in the brief. Here, that's exactly what you'd have to do because he does not set them forth when he states his error, and he does not do that within the statement of the facts. There's no way for you to even know where it was preserved.
But our case has established that that particular rule violation is kind of a dealer's choice. We can either comb or not comb. It's up to us.
Yes, sir, which is why I point to the fact that even in the statement of the facts, he does not make any references to the transcripts in the case.
Were you prejudiced in your ability to defend the case by the lack of those citations, do you think? And if so, how?
No, sir. I already had them written up in my memoranda that I submitted. I gave to the trial court in this matter. But I think that, you know, here we've got accumulation of procedural errors, which I think should prohibit the appellant from getting to the court on any of it. And I don't think that the filing of the transcript late is something that the court could overlook. I think that is mandatory.
Basically,
in
what
this
you're
particular
saying
case.
Is that the filing of the transcript is looked at in a different way, and the cases seem to suggest that as comparing the failure to cite in the transcript where the error of the trial court was made. In other words, one thing is jurisdictional, the other thing is not jurisdictional.
Correct, and I think the filing of the transcript is jurisdictional at this point. And I apologize for stating the wrong number of days.
Although some of the older cases say it is actually jurisdictional, the more recent cases say it's not jurisdictional. However, given your opponent's concession that we can't reach the assignments of errors without the transcript, then it falls into the category of it was necessary even if it wasn't.
Yes, sir. And that was the argument I think I made in my brief as well. I think I even filed a secondary addition to the appendix because the court had not ruled on my initial motion at the time briefs became due. Does the court have any more questions? Thank you all.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wolk, you have your rebuttal remaining.
The appellee accuses me of asking the court to look outside the record, but he doesn't say where I'm asking the court to look that is outside the record.
I'm guessing that's the transcript that's an issue.
If that's what he's referring to, that makes sense, but we've already plowed that field, so I will not address that further. I will note that the additions to the appendix submitted by the appellee deal with a whole lot of things that are not relevant to this appeal. One thing that obviously is very relevant to the appeal is the St. Simons Island property, and I must feel like I must address a misapprehension or miscomprehension of the facts as laid out. If you look at the relevant documents regarding the 1031 exchange, you'll see that they relate back to a memorandum of agreement between Ms. Browning and Mr. Browning's law firm from back in February of 1997. That is found.
This was one of the most slow motion divorces in the history of the world, wasn't it?
I cannot disagree with that one bit. And I'm just thankful I wasn't involved in it from the beginning. The memorandum of agreement or understanding is found at page 432 of the appendix, showing where the law firm is buying the interest of Ms. Browning in two properties that the law firm held, one being in Abingdon at 200 Court Street, the law firm offices, and then a smaller interest in property located in Lebanon in Russell County, also law firm offices. That money, that is the money that was funneled through the intermediary, Mr. Bowie, and then used in the Section 1031 exchange.
Let me stop you there because I had some question about that. The money that came from the law firm, why was that her separate property?
Judge, I guess the answer to that is they were buying, if you accept the trial court's version of events at the law firm, they were buying their peace with Ms. Browning.
But if he sold his interest in the law firm and they put the money, I mean, that money came into him during the marriage, that would be marital property. So I don't understand why her interest in the law firm isn't also marital.
Well,
did the agreement specify that he continued to have an interest in the law firm?
Absolutely. He still owns that till today. So this was just in real estate owned by the firm, not an actual interest in the firm itself, but in two separate parcels of real estate.
So she owned an interest. She had owned real estate, effectively.
She was essentially co-tenants with the firm.
She had a marital interest in his interest in the firm's owning of the buildings.
I think that would be a fair.
Was it a marital interest or was it an actual interest? Was she an owner of that property?
She was listed as an owner.
So, and I'm assuming that because they got married before he got out of law school, her interest in that property came into being during the marriage.
That's correct.
So that's marital property.
That is
not.
That is correct, with the exception of how you look at the memorandum of understanding between the firm and Ms. Browning that they agreed to sell to her.
Do we have that memorandum of understanding?
It's at page 432 of the appendix. And the Section 1031 exchange documents, exchange agreements, are found at page 784 and 794 of the appendix as well. And then the appendix also contains the deposit tickets from the intermediary showing where the firm paid the money to him.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. We will come down and greet counsel. Then we will take up our next case of Cock versus Commonwealth. I hate that.